This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special 4th of July weekend edition of the program. If you're a regular listener, you've heard Americans from just about every possible background, no matter what part of our country they came from, how much money they had or didn't have, what their political views were, or what their ethnic background was. We've heard veteran after veteran echo that idea that it took a truly united United States of America to defeat, with the help of its allies, the tyrannical forces that threatened the very concept of freedom and World War II. For 33,000 American veterans of Japanese ancestry, it meant believing the ideals of the American experiment were worth fighting for, even when they had been stripped away from them on account of their heritage. Sherman Kishi was on his way to the Philippines at this time 75 years ago, but to understand his reality in 1945, we have to go back to December 7th, 1941, in his native Livingston, California.
I was playing tennis in high school, and I was on the high school team. And so we practiced a lot of tennis. And this was early Sunday morning. There were four of us that went to play at the high school tennis courts to try to improve our game. And we were playing at the high school tennis courts. And as we were playing there, a car stopped by the side of the road. There were two or three men in the car, I don't remember. But they opened their windows and started to curse at us and call us all kinds of names. And it just really made us feel bad. And so, of course, we quit very shortly and went home. And came home, and when we came home, we heard on the radio that Pearl Harbor had happened. And that was a change for all the United States and all the world, really, basically. But I think maybe a little bit more for some of us of Japanese ancestry in the United States. We went on to school after 9066 until about May. And then in May of that year, 1942, the orders came out, and there were posters on the telephone poles and fence posts that told us that we had to go to an assembly center. At that stage, we quit school and got prepared to have to leave. So that's what happened during that period of time.
And you tell that very matter-of-factly, but I'm sure at the time that was quite a shock to you and had to be pretty emotional to be a 17-year-old kid and being told the place you've lived your whole life, you're not welcome anymore.
Yeah, it was very much so. It was particularly difficult, I think, for our parents. You have to remember that our parents were quite young yet. Many of the parents were in their 40s, late 40s, and in their 50s. And so they were in the prime of their life, and they had farmed here all their lives, and all of a sudden, everybody had to leave. So I know that once this had happened, they became so fearful of anything that was Japanese that I remember anything that we had in the house that looked a little bit Japanesey, as much as we could, we destroyed, buried, or burned. And that happened to all the families in the area. So that's the kind of thing that happened during that period of time. Yeah. And, you know, interestingly, they gave us this notice about 3 weeks before we had to go. The day that we went on was my 17th birthday. So I remember it very vividly. This was May the 13th of 1942. And that's the day we went into the Assembly Center in Merced.
Which is where the Merced County Fairgrounds are now?
Yes, it's where the fairground is now. We have put up a monument there in memory of that with all the names of the people that are on a wall. So that's where we got sent in. And I remember mostly being put onto buses at our church. And then we went on the bus to Merced. And we went to the, it used to be the armory there, right on 17th Street, and it's still there. And they took us there, and the first time we got there, we got out of the bus right in front, and there was a gentleman who was a dentist from San Francisco that spoke to us and told us that we had to behave and do what they asked us to do, and basically that's what we did and went into the Assembly Center, which was mostly prepared at that time.
How scared and unsettled were you? Because that seems like a pretty imposing and uncertain future you were facing.
You know, when you're young like that, you don't think of that as much. But I'm sure that the parents were very upset. For some of us who were at that age, were young teenagers yet, it was sort of fun because we never met so many Japanese people in our lives. And very shortly after going into the camp, we had some very well-educated people who had gone to college, unable to get jobs because jobs weren't available to people of Japanese descent. And so they were well-educated, And they immediately started things within the camp. And one of the things that started was baseball. And baseball became a very popular pastime in Merced Assembly Center as it was in the later relocation camps. So there were things like talent shows. I remember very vividly one talent show that we went to that had a young lady from Walnut Grove who had a beautiful contralto voice. And one of the most popular songs that was sung at the time was God Bless America. Can you imagine? Yeah, that's what happened during those days, yeah.
And the irony, huh? God bless America when you're basically being held prisoner by America.
That's exactly right, yeah. But we didn't think of it that way, I guess. All of this area was sent to Amache, Colorado. Camp Amache, it was called. It's right at Grenada, Colorado, which is in the southeastern corner of Colorado.
And what was life like there?
Like every other camp, it was in the most desolate place that they could find. Really, I think it was the most desolate place that they could find in Colorado. And they had trouble finding places for these camps. We know that it was cold in the winter. It was dusty because almost all the camps were made by dozing off the sagebrush wherever it may be. That was included Topaz, included Heart Mountain. All the camps were the same, and all the Arizona camps were all the same. One of the most violent and worst thing that we remember is the dust storms that we used to have, because they were so bad. But we all lived through that, eventually made the relocation camps a livable place. They planted trees and planted gardens, and things changed in those camps.
And how did it come about that you decided to go fight for the country that was holding your family hostage?
In 1942, after 9066, there was still a draft going on, of course, and they changed the status of all people of Japanese ancestry from a 1A status to a 4C status, which was an enemy alien status. So we were no longer eligible for the draft. So I, in 1942 and 43, I finished my high school. And during that period of time, they came in to recruit for the 442nd. I couldn't get into the service at that stage. But just before I graduated, they also came in to recruit for MIS. And I studied a little bit of Japanese in the camp. I had a very, very smattering of Japanese in the community before the war, but very little. And so I studied a little bit in camp, learned a little bit of the alphabet, basically. And when they came in, they accepted me. I had talked to my father about this, and I told him that I wanted to go. And he said, "This is your country. You go right ahead and do what you think is best." So my father approved my going as well.
And some folks might not know what MIS stands for. That's Military Intelligence Service?
That's correct. Yeah, Military Intelligence Service is what we were in. You know, when I got out of school, I had to go to basic training after that, after I learned my Japanese. And so by the time I was eligible to go overseas, it was starting to get a little late in the war. And I was ready in 1945, finally, after basic training and after my training. I went through a 9-month program of learning Japanese.
Was that hard for you?
Oh, was that ever hard? Can you imagine getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and getting ready for reveille and all that, and then going to class at 8 o'clock, staying in class until 4 o'clock, and then having your military things after that. And then we went back to classes at 7 o'clock at night, and we stayed there until at least 9. And so we had all that time to learn the Japanese language, and it was not easy, and we didn't have enough time. So we used to put flashlights under the blanket. We used to go to the latrine where there's light, and we used to study so we could learn enough to get by. Yeah, it was the toughest schooling that I ever went through.
I know you lived it, and it's easy to maybe in retrospect not read too much into it. But I think a lot of people that didn't go through what you went through think, where do you find the motivation to put in that kind of effort, again, for a government, for a country that is holding your family prisoner, as you know, that you've had to move away from the land that you've had your entire life, and here they are in this internment camp. How did you get past that mentally and emotionally, and how would you describe the mindset you did have?
You know, I didn't think about that very much, frankly. This was our country. This is the only country that we knew, and this is the only country we're loyal to. All we thought about was doing what we needed to do for our own country. We knew that Japan, our folks came from Japan, but that really didn't cut any ice with us because we never knew any of those people over there. And so they became our enemies, basically.
And that attitude you described, did you feel like that was pretty common among the other men that you were training with?
Yes, I think so. I think so. Although you have to realize that when we went to the MIS, there were many young men who were called kibes. And kibe means a young person of the ancestry who were sent back as citizens from the United States to Japan to be educated. And so there were many of those people that were in MIS. And some of them had some completely different feelings about it. There were some of the kibes who were very hopeful that Japan would win. But basically, they were very loyal to the United States. And most of the translating and interpreting that was done in the Pacific was basically done by the kibes. The niseis were not very strong in Japanese, and so they did most of the English writing that had to be done on the reports and things. And so you have to give a lot of credit to those young men who learned the language in Japan and came back and fought for the United States. We waited for a while, and in July of 1945, I got onto a ship out of San Francisco, and I remember the Golden Gate Bridge going away, wove our way back and forth across the Pacific. It took us a whole month to get to the Philippines. I was, along with many other the young men, were put into what they call ADIS, which is Allied Translating and Interpreting Section. This is of MIS. There's a racetrack right out of Manila, and that's where we were stationed. And we did some translating and things while we're there. I was there for about a month, and of course the war ended in August. By the middle of August, it was all done. Japan had surrendered. And so shortly thereafter, they sent us into Japan as part of the occupation forces.
A lot of people don't even realize how much of a challenge it was for a lot of Japanese-American families to get their land back, if that was even an option. In your case, here you are on the property where you were born. How did that work out? How was it that your family came to recover this land after the war was over?
My family was not part of the cooperatives. So we asked our high school ag teacher, who we knew was a very nice gentleman, to run our farm for us, and his name was Eldon Callister. He ran our farm for us during that period of time, and the person that was what we call the chicken doctor, because we had chickens across the street there, egg-laying chickens, and he took over our house and continued that business there, and I think they all did quite well farming for us during that period of time because they left some money in the bank for us when we came back. So we had some very fortunate friends to have. Most of the people that lived in the cities lost their businesses, lost everything that they had, and they didn't have too much to begin with. So when they came back, they had to start all over again, and it was very difficult for them.
When you think about your children and your grandchildren, what do you hope that they understand about what Japanese Americans went through in America during World War II, what you and your family went through? What do you hope they know years and years from now?
Well, that's a pretty tough question. I think that the thing that they will probably learn is that this country, which is unique in the world, I think, is able to do things to right what was done that was wrong at the particular time. And this country did do that for us. They righted the wrong when they had the redress action back in 1988. There was a lot of activity that went into that. It took 10 years before this happened. There were many congressional hearings and things that went on. But at that time, they gave an apology to us for letting that happen. And they, of course, they gave us some redress as well. They gave us each $20,000 as a result of the relocation that they did. And one of the things that I prize the most is the apology that came from President Bush, because he was the president at the time that they sent the letters out. So I hope that the children will look at that and realize what a great country we have.
The voice of Sherman Kishi. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And we're not done yet. When this Independence Day edition of the program continues, somebody who understood what the double V meant in World War II, one of the Mumford Point Marines. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.